813. You're going to be able to call in and talk to Ralph about healthcare, vaccinations, what's wrong, and what's right with our healthcare today. I'm Sherry Edwards, your host, and this is Sound Health on BBS Radio, bringing you information and options for self-health. Before we go to Ralph, there's a few announcements that I'd like to make. I am announcing that our name is going to be Good Vibrations with Sherry Edwards. We think that title is very fitting, and just because that's the way we want it to be. We think it fits with the idea of bringing in information about vibrational and energy medicine. Number two announcement, we're having a lot of trouble with our email. I've given you an address of radio@vocalprofiling.com, and I want to give you an alternative one. I'll be announcing it again later. soundhealth@soundhealth.org. So if you've written to us on email and you haven't got an answer, use that alternative email or fax, write, call, and I'll give you those numbers later. For those of you who have got in touch with us and offered suggestions for the show, really some great ideas. Keep them coming, and we'll keep bringing you good information. Our guest tonight has great information. It's just incredible to the way we run our lives. As most of you know, I run a small research center in Ohio that attempts to study the human voice and its effect on sound presentation, or its effect of sound as presented to you on your health and wellness. I'm losing my voice tonight. I meet a great many very interesting people in my line of work, and my favorite kind of person is someone who's real, kind of what you see is what you get, and you feel like you know them, you're very comfortable with them, and that's the kind of person that we have on with us tonight. He is an attorney. That doesn't sound much like an attorney, but I think Ralph is one of those few attorneys that ever going to end up in heaven. He's doing a lot to help establish laws that deal with protecting our health. He's worked with Dr. Levin, his case to help establish new law in New York, and he works with Hulda Clark and her people. We're going to talk about Codex, vaccinations, what's wrong and what's right about our health. Ralph, welcome, and thank you for agreeing to join us from the East Coast, where it's probably very late there.
Yes, indeed, Sherry. It's a bit late, but it's always great to talk to you.
Well,
good evening.
Thank you. Your website is vitaminlawyer.com.
How
did you get that name and reputation?
All right. Well, I've been an attorney in New Jersey for about 34 years, but the title comes from the work I've been doing with people in the vitamin industry for, well, most of those 34 years, certainly. I've been doing a lot of work with individuals in the industry, making sure that their claims and their websites meet the standards that are set, and helping them understand what the rules and regulations are that apply to them. Tonight we're going to talk a lot about the way the legal system impacts the type of choices that individuals get to make about their own health care, about taking dominion over their own health care. And, you know, it might be nice to start with a quotation from an old statute, or actually an old court case from over 100 years ago. Back in the beginning of the 20th century, new laws were being adopted in order to protect the public from charlatans in the healthcare field. And it came to pass that the question was raised once these new licensing laws were adopted, whether people could practice alternatives to standard licensed medicine. And in North Carolina, the Supreme Court heard a case that involved that issue, whether a person who was not a licensed physician could nonetheless teach people about how to have greater health. And this is what the court said in holding that, of course, individuals were free to go to whomever they wanted for their health care. The quotation is, "The state has not restricted the cure of the body to the practice of medicine and surgery, allopathy, as it is termed, nor require that before anyone can be treated for any bodily ill, the physician must have acquired a competent knowledge of allopathy and be licensed by those skilled therein. To do that would be to limit progress by establishing allopathy as the state system of healing and forbidding all others. This would be as foreign to our system as a state church for the cure of souls. All the state has done has been to enact that when one wished to practice medicine or surgery, he must, as a protection to the public, not to the doctor, be examined and licensed by those skilled in surgery and medicine. To restrict all healings of that one kind to allopathy, excluding homeopathy, osteopathy, and all other treatments, might be a protection to the doctors in surgery and medicine, but that's not the object of the act, and might make it unconstitutional because creating a monopoly. And so, you know, for a long time, the issue of who was going to control access to health care has been a significant issue, way longer than just the past 100 years, of course. But in the past century, new systems have come about, systems of licensing that people hoped would protect them.
For the listeners out there, can you define allopathic as...
Allopathy is the standard form of medicine and surgery. Allopathy means curing by dissimilars, just as homeopathy means curing with similars. In allopathy, if there's a disease, let's say you have a fever, well, you might give the person a medication to remove the fever and cover up the symptom. In homeopathy, you might instead give a remedy that would actually cause the fever to go its course and the body to heal itself.
So somebody going to their MD because they have poison ivy would be considered allopathic.
Right.
How does that relate to alternative medicine?
Well, that's exactly what the quotation is about. It's about the idea that just because there's a licensing law for dentistry and medicine and surgery doesn't mean that all other forms of treatment have been forbidden. And the quote from the court talks about homeopathy and osteopathy. Back in those days, osteopathy was considered, you know, far out alternative medicine, and today it's just one branch of medicine. So things that are at one period of time considered beyond the fringe are in a later period of time considered, you know, part of the standard. And we see that happening today as well, in which a number of different alternative therapies are beginning to be recognized by the healthcare system as alternatives that are available to everyone. Of course, the best example of this is acupuncture. Going from a period of time when acupuncture was being actively forbidden by various bodies, it's now very much a standard part of the healthcare system.
Where would you put chiropractic?
And chiropractic is, of course, another, you know, excellent example of that. And in fact, that leads us to another angle on this issue of where can people go for healthcare. Back in the 1990s, the other end of the 20th century, there was some litigation between the chiropractors and the MDs. And as a result of that litigation, the AMA adopted some changes to its ethics code. You know, back in the beginning, the ethics of healers were very straightforward, you know, do no harm. But nowadays it's a 100-page booklet. With very many specific directions in it. And there's a new one, and it talks about very, very legalistic terms, a distinction, if you will, between treatment of disease, which is what doctors do, licensed physicians do, and therapeutic services, which is what other people do. And in the past, there's always been some tension between the MDs and others in the healing world, and who's in and who's out, as it were. And so the Code of Ethics attempts to help doctors understand when they can cooperate with people who are not MDs. And what it says now is that a physician is free to refer a patient, as they say, for therapeutic or diagnostic services to another physician to a limited practitioner, by which of course they mean chiropractors and people like that, or to any other provider of healthcare services permitted by law to furnish such services whenever he or she believes that this may benefit the patient. And that's a big change. I mean, it's a small words, but big change. And I guess only lawyers tend to understand how small words can lead to big changes. But in the past, anyone who's offered any alternative therapy to the standard treatments has been told that they're, you know, an unscientific practitioner, and you know, they're outside, they're illegal, they're practicing medicine without a license, whatever it may be. Now, there's a different standard. If the therapeutic service may benefit that person, then it's something that can be allowed. It doesn't have to actually treat the disease or cure the disease, which is a very high standard, and it should be. You know, we don't want people claiming to cure a disease unless they can really cure it. We want them to pretend to have something that's going to benefit the people when those people are ill, and it might lead those people to away from the treatments that might help. And so so when anyone claims to have a treatment of a disease, they have a very high standard to meet before they can make that claim. That's why it costs $800 million to put a new drug through the farm, through the system that approves new drugs. And on the other hand, the sort of natural remedies that alternative therapies offer have a long tradition of use behind them, and are not really subject to that standard of proof. They just have to meet a standard that is a little easier, perhaps, this may benefit standard. And that standard means that that they don't need to spend $1 billion on proving that they do what everyone knows they do anyway, because they've been used for thousands of years in some cases. This traditional use concept is one that even the Federal Trade Commission has basically accepted as a valid source of information for people. What the FTC says is that claims based on historical or traditional use should be substantiated by confirming scientific evidence. But at the same time, they should be presented, as it says, in a way that consumers understand that the basis of the claim is a history of use of the product for a particular purpose. And, of course, that's important because so many of these food-based products have traditional uses that simply can't be made subject to this double-blind placebo system that's been set up, because it's in no one's economic interest to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars to prove that vitamin C helps people feel better when they have a cold, for example. It's sort of built into the system that way, I guess. Let's see.
Hello? I have a question.
Hello?
Hello?
Sure.
I have a question. Can anybody hear me? Hi, I'm told I'm supposed to just cut in and say I have a question.
Yes, we can hear you. I can hear you, Sherry. Can you hear?
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
I have a question. Does anybody hear me?
I can hear you.
Hello, I have a question about what you're talking about. Hello? Yes? Hello?
I can hear you. Can you hear me? Sherry, can you hear me?
Can anybody hear me?
I wonder who is on the actual radio program right now. Oh, yes, Ralph is here. Hello? Hello, this is Ralph.
Are you the only one on the air?
I guess I'm the only one on the air. This is Sherry Edwards' program. I'm being interviewed by her.
Yeah, but is Sherry on the line?
She doesn't seem to be on the line.
When did this occur?
I was in the middle of...
Don, I'm on the line.
There. Oh, you are on the line, Sherry.
Yes.
Oh, so I apologize. Something's... I apologize.
Yep. Someone was trying to call in and ask a question, and that sort of knocked
the ball off. Yeah, let's try that again and see if we can get them on the line.
All right.
Yes. Caller? Yeah, we're going to put you on the line. We're going to put you on the line now.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Is anybody there?
You're on the air.
Can you hear me?
I think we got a glitch
in the
system.
I'm on the line now. Hello, are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Are you there?
No, I don't think we're... Hello?
Dawn?
Hello? I'm on, too.
She still can't
Hello?
Hear us, Dawn.
She can't hear them.
Yes. Hello, I'm here.
Go ahead with your question.
You know what I think? Just keep going. We'll figure this out as we go. Don't worry about it. Just talk. Do your interview. And, just let us, see what happened. James, you're an electrical fella. That's a little strange.
Ralph, are you still on the line with us?
I'm absolutely still on the line.
Okay, I was reading the NIH 5-year plan, and they
Sherry?
Yes?
Yeah, really, that is, I don't understand why that's going on, that, you know, with the caller calling in?
Well, when she comes back, we'll just, she can jump right in.
Do you just want me to keep putting them through, or do you want me to beep you?
Beep us first.
Okay, you got it.
Okay. Ralph, in reading the NIH 5-year plan, I noticed two odd things. One, they are calling osteopathic manipulation alternative medicine.
Well, it was 100-some-odd years ago. It was alternative medicine at that time. You know, we could hear you, but you couldn't hear us.
But I would think that osteopathic medicine is very well accepted. The other thing that they were doing with this 5-year plan, they are accepting alternatives to this double-blind placebo effect. Because like massage, there probably isn't a double-blind effect except massage and no massage.
Right. Yes.
Where would you put things like biofeedback, psychoanalysis, meditation, physical therapy, musical therapy? Where do those fit?
Yeah, the very fact that you can give me in a few seconds just rattle off a half a dozen items, and we could probably rattle off another 50 or 60 items in the next minute or so of therapies that might benefit people that are still considered alternatives. That shows us how much is out there and how people are looking for alternatives, because frankly they wouldn't be there if there wasn't a demand in the marketplace for that. They all fit in literally as these therapies that may benefit.
Who controls the licensure and says we can say this or we can say that?
That, of course, is a real key issue, because you go from the formal legal system to the informal controls of the marketplace. And it's the insurance companies that exercise those controls because they have the money. You know the golden rule, he who has the gold makes the rules.
That's good. I know you do a lot of product labeling. You look at people's websites and what they're saying in their catalogs. Is there things that you can say and you can't say so people can stay out of trouble?
Sure. In fact, it depends on the type of product that you're selling. If you're selling a traditional over-the-counter drug product, then that product has what's called a monograph, which is an official statement as to what type of claims you can make about it. If you're selling a vitamin product, which, you know, and under our law, vitamins are foods, you can basically tell how that vitamin product helps support the normal structure and function of the body. What it does in the body to support our normal metabolism, to support our normal life. You can't, of course, with food products, make a claim that the product will cure disease. To make that sort of claim, you have to, as I said, go through that $900 million process, whatever it may be. But, of course, people aren't really looking for a magic bullet. They're looking for changes in lifestyle and changes in the type of foods they eat and the type of supplements they take that in the long term make a real big impact on their health and well-being. They're looking to take over control of their own health care, because turning it over to the experts has proven to be a little dangerous, as we know now. As they say, a doctor in hospital caused disease is one of the very highest causes of death in this society. We're talking about literally hundreds of thousands of people a year who died because they sought therapy for their diseases through the standard medical system.
Most people know.
See the fact that the more money that's made available to the system, the more money that's spent. And the latest example of that is this new prescription drug benefit. Let's see, who does it benefit? I presume the producers of prescription drugs, but this particular benefit is going to, once again, result in an increase in price and an increase in the availability of drugs that are, you know, for, I guess, less and less serious problems, and the drugs themselves have more and more serious side effects. It's interesting, this word side effect. It's a good lesson in how one can sort of market, you know, market a problem. It's called a side effect, and substances have effects. You take an unusual chemical, you know, burbling away in a lab, and swallow it. That's, of course, what you're doing with a pharmaceutical, and you get a bunch of effects. One of these effects is something that helps change the symptom of some disease, and that's the effect you want, so you call it the therapeutic effect. And a whole bunch of other effects, which do things that you don't like, sometimes leading to death, you call the side effects, and sort of tuck them in the bottom of the label where nobody notices them. And if they looked carefully, they might realize that the benefit they're getting is not worth the risk they're taking. Approved drugs are allowed to have side effects.
Healthcare is moving more from benefits to the people to almost getting dictatorial. I just read an article in one of those little Sunday magazines that said, go and talk to your hospital about how much they're charging you for a certain procedure, because you may get them to reduce the price, because the insurance company pays a lot less for that procedure than you do as an individual. I was shocked by that.
That's right. That's the power of large-scale buying, of course. And it is shocking to our sensibilities, but it's also understandable that the insurer that spends lots of money can dictate the price it pays to a greater degree than any individual can ever do. Is that good or bad? Well, it is the power of money. And it's through that power that the insurance system tries to limit the costs. You know, there are all these different factors at work. Insurance companies make money by providing services, and if they never paid a single claim, they would never have any customers and make no money. So they have that pressure on them. On the other hand, the less they pay for the services, the more money they'll make in terms of their bottom line. And so there's a lot of factors at work that lead them to want to control the situation. Insurance companies like to control risks. That's what they're in the business of doing. And certainly being ill is a risk that people want to be insured against.
I was very surprised to learn recently that my insurance company dictates how much the doctor can charge me, no matter what his prices are, and equally surprised, shocked, and appalled to find out that if I didn't have insurance, I would be paying less for my prescription.
That's interesting. And how would the economics of that work, where the person, the individual, that's very interesting.
Well, the insurance company, mine at least, is trying to dictate that I buy my drugs from them, and I'm on a simple thyroid medication, so it's not like it's a lot of money, but they want me to buy them directly from them, go directly to their lab, and so they're charging me an outrageous, what I consider outrageous, fee, because I want
they're
to
able
buy
to,
them.
To exercise a monopoly position with you.
Yeah.
Because they have you as a captured customer.
I want to buy them at my local store because I trust that pharmacist to give me their real thyroid, and I can't deal with generic thyroid. We found that out, and it's all in the literature, too, that generic thyroid just doesn't work as well. But the insurance company is insisting that I get generic thyroid. And even with the doctor saying this doesn't work well for her, I just don't trust them to send me the real thing. But I don't trust doctors very well, mm-hmm. and I don't trust insurance companies. When you read something like iatrogenic disease causes 150,000 deaths a year, and you introduced me to a new word today, nosocomial, am I pronouncing
right?
Right,
yeah, it's hospital-caused disease.
Well,
people go in, come in and out sicker than they went in, as it were.
Well, it says 1 in 10 patients get a nosocomial infection. That's 2 million patients a year, and this causes 88,000 deaths. And
that's more deaths than I believe automobile accidents cause.
Wow. Yeah. It says in the range of $4.5 billion to $11 billion. Dollars it costs. Well, no wonder insurance premiums are going up. You go to the hospital and get sicker. But the definition of this, it says nosocomial infections are those which are a result of treatment in a hospital or hospital-like setting, but secondary to the patient's original condition.
Right. In addition to the problem they had when they started, they end up with the infection. Exactly. And that sort of experience is why people are looking for alternatives. They want to not have to go into that hospital emergency room. But on the other hand, there are occasions when you need that emergency allopathic care. And for those occasions that you need it, it's because the system is there, but the system has to be maintained for all occasions, as it were. The hospital is so expensive because it has to be there when you need it. So they can charge, for example, I heard somewhere $12 for an aspirin. I think an aspirin can't possibly cost $12. But getting that aspirin to the patient, and maintaining that 12-story building in which the patient is sitting, that, the overhead costs $12 for an aspirin. Maybe not $12, it probably costs somewhat less, and they have a profit, of course, built in. But that's how that system operates.
I've heard some people suggest, too, that people should just pay their own doctors out of their own pocket and just keep catastrophic insurance.
That may be a good strategy, especially for younger people.
When we had one kind of insurance for our employees, and we paid something like $8,600 with a small company a year to this insurance company, and they paid one physician visit for one person of $136. Now, we just bought insurance that nobody's going to get sick, and they're willing to take that risk on the other side.
That was a good gamble for them that year.
Yeah, absolutely, in our case, at least.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to talk to Ralph, our number here is 888-268-4313. Ralph, is your practice exclusively health-related?
To a very great extent. Of course, over the years, I've done a lot of other stuff, but in recent years, I've really tried to restrict what I'm doing to working with people in the alternative healing community and the complementary community and in the vitamin and supplement industry.
If someone came to you with a product that they wanted to, say, put on their internet, what kinds of things would you help with them with?
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell them to go to my vitaminlawyer.com website first and poke a look around a little bit. There are some good articles that can help them and some information there. And what I do with people is when they first contact me, and the magic of the internet, I'm getting contacted every week by people who have new product ideas that they want to bring to market. I have an explanatory memo that about 4 pages sketches the road for a dietary supplement to get from an idea to an actual product, and then I help the client along the way step by step. And there are many steps. You've got to first make sure that the product is going to be allowed to be sold as a dietary supplement. You got to make sure that the product is labeled properly to be sold properly, to be sold as a dietary supplement. There are some tricks that have to be, little hoops that have to be jumped through to make sure that it complies. And then you have to make sure that the claims that the client is making about the product, what they're telling the public the product does and doesn't do, are accurate and have substantiation behind them before the person can actually go out there and do it. And then there's some notices that have to be filed depending on the type of claim you're making. If you're making a claim about the relationship between the dietary substance and states of health, then you have to ask the FDA in advance for approval for that claim. But if you're making claims about the relationship between the dietary supplement and the normal structure and function of the body, you know, how it supports our normal abilities and normal normal lives, then you don't have to tell them about that claim until 30 days after actually marketing the claim, and it's a very formal notice. You just basically tell them what the claim is, and there's no government approval of those claims. So when people see dietary supplements being advertised and make claims about what those substances do in the body, those claims have not been reviewed by the government in advance. Very, very few have, and we remember that, you know, the few that the government has approved that are of these stronger health claim versions. For example, the one about the folic acid and neural tube defects. It took years for them to approve that, and they sort of had to be forced through some litigation in order to do it. There was a very famous case back in the beginning of this decade called Pearson versus Shalala, in which Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw brought the FDA to court, and the courts held that the FDA's logjam on health claims had to loosen up, and the government had to start approaching the question of approved health claims in a much more open way and allow what are called qualified claims, claims that aren't 100% sure yet, but the claim is about benefits that people should know about. And so there's been a change of attitude on the part of the regulators to some extent. And that change of attitude has allowed the American supplement market to flourish. It's the most vibrant market of that sort in the world. And that leads us to one topic that we should be talking about in the latter half of the show. The new regulations that are coming down on an international level that may help or hinder our access to good high-dosage dietary supplements.
Could I ask you one question about services before we move there?
Mm-hmm.
For people offering services on the Internet or on their brochures, what should they watch for?
Well, you know, unless they're selling an approved drug, they have to watch for any claims that they're diagnosing disease or prescribing for a disease or treating a disease or curing it or preventing it, for that matter. And that can get tricky. And I give you an example of just how tricky. We all know that certain foods help lower bad cholesterol and help raise good cholesterol. And those foods can either be part of a diet or they can be, you know, part of a dietary supplement. The vitamin industry is not allowed to say that certain dietary supplements lower bad cholesterol. They can't say that because one of the pharmaceutical companies got approval for a drug that lowers cholesterol levels. And the FDA has taken the position that that means that there is now a disease known as hypercholesterolemia. That's high cholesterol levels. And since there's a drug to treat it, dietary supplements can't claim to have the same effect, or else they would be drugs. And so while a dietary supplement, a seller can say that this substance helps to maintain cholesterol levels that are already normal, or helps to maintain normal cholesterol levels, they can't say that the substance lowers cholesterol levels. And so it becomes a very fine tuning. Unfortunately, you really need a lawyer to help you walk through that landmine, the field of landmines that are those regulations. I mean, most people would find the distinction between this substance lowers cholesterol and this substance maintains normal cholesterol to be a very fine distinction and not that easy to understand. But in the legal system, it's a significant distinction.
So that term may benefit is very, very significant here.
Right, because it's a different standard. It's a standard that allows the marketplace to develop products and and ideas, in a way which the old standard stifled those developments.
Should people have waivers that people sign if they're going to be a complementary service?
Well, there's no question that individuals who are providing alternative healthcare services have to follow all the normal procedures. They really want to get the informed consent of their client, and they want the client to understand what's happening. They want to make sure that they get the signature on the type of standard informed consent form that that hospitals and doctors have used for many, many years.
There's a very cute thing, I think, is going on with diet
mm-hmm.
that you were talking about a second ago. All of this push by the government to label overweight and obesity as a disease, and overweight hasn't been a disease so far, but there's really a big push to label it a disease. Do you think
right.
that so pharmaceuticals can then claim anything like diet foods or diet pills? Well, diet pills they already claim, but even something like exercise. Are we going to be restricted by subscription on who can get exercise because it's been a prescription?
A doctor's prescription in order to join a health club.
Yeah.
Well, if you have a doctor's prescription to join a health club, maybe an insurance carrier will cover it for you. So that's the carrot and the stick, I guess.
So it has a good and bad side.
Mm-hmm.
If people want, I don't know what phone number you want used. Can you give a phone number where people can get in touch with you?
I would rather people contact me over the internet. If you go to vitaminlawyer.com. And my email address is on there in many different places, and I respond to emails very quickly. If I had a lot of people calling me, I would have no time to work with the people I work with, help
okay.
clients that I help. And so emails are much, much more efficient. And if people are selling on the Internet, then they should be able to communicate on the Internet.
In your opinion, why is, and I know this is a big, big question, why does healthcare, personal healthcare today, need protected? What went wrong that we need to be protected from a system?
We gave over control of our own healthcare to experts, and then the experts gave over control of their profession to insurance companies. And I think that's really what went wrong. I think the medical profession accepted the siren call of all the money that was being put on the table. And we know right now that an enormous amount of taxpayer money and an enormous amount of insurance money is on the table, paying for those hospitals, enormous hospitals, and paying for the huge superstructure that exists in the pharmaceutical industry. This money is very powerful, and money matters in this society.
I think it's really strange.
Really all about money. That's what it's about. It's not
we're
about
the
dealing.
Consumer, though. Yeah. Shouldn't we have a say?
Oh, absolutely.
We're the ones paying for this.
That's right.
Where did we go wrong?
We gave over control of our health care to experts.
Well, then how can we get...
And when you do that, you become a dependent, a patient, instead of a participant in your own health.
How can we get it back?
In the past, people relied on Dr. Mom. Now they rely on a trillion-dollar system.
Well, in some states, Dr. Mom is even illegal. You can't tell your kid to take an aspirin.
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if anybody's ever been prosecuted for doing that.
Can you talk a bit about Codex? I know you've been working many long hours and
mm-hmm.
months.
Codex is another example of a good idea gone wrong. Codex Alimentarius, the Latin phrase, means the food code. That's what it means. It's the international food code. And its purpose is to help countries harmonize their food regulations so that international trade is simpler. But the effect is to try to impose a system on the vitamin world which would be very destructive of the innovation and best development in that world. And the way it works is, insidious. It's always a little word here and a little word there that changes things. And in the International Food Code, what they've done is they've decided not to treat vitamins as foods, and of course that's what they are, dietary supplements or foods, they decided to treat them as though they were drugs or industrial chemicals, and thereby subject them to the same sort of standards that you would with a dangerous drug or an industrial chemical. And that standard is something called toxic risk analysis, where you look at the substance and you say, well, what is the most of the substance that we can have without having any effect on the body? Because, you know, these are dangerous substances and we don't want them to have any effect. And when you apply that standard to a food, you get some very weird results. For example, applying it to the food known as vitamin C, you get a recommendation that nobody should take more than, you know, 60 milligrams of vitamin C a day, because anything more than that would have an effect on the body. You know, if you don't have at least 60 milligrams a day, you get scurvy. You get the deficiency disease scurvy. But vitamin C's role in your normal structure and function isn't to prevent scurvy. Its role is very diverse and absolutely necessary for normal metabolism and a normal functioning body. And for that normal metabolism and normal body, you need several grams a day, which you get from food sources, and in our modern lives, very often we need to get by supplementing our diets. So like proper biochemical or nutritional analysis says that you need several grams at least a day. A toxic risk analysis says you can't take more than 60 milligrams, which is a tiny fraction of a gram. And that's how Codex would work. It would basically outlaw the dosages that matter. It would limit us to levels of supplementation that would be ineffective for any use.
Well, that's really important.
And that's the problem.
The human body doesn't make vitamin C. So if they're adulterating our food and they're going to try to put the kibosh on whether or not we can get nutrients or not, what does that mean to the consumer?
Well, that's why one of the physicians I know who's very, very active in this issue has done a DVD called Nutricide. The idea that these rules literally will kill people. Dr. Rima Labo is an MD from New York who has laid aside her practice, as she says, in order to help heal the body politic, and she's formed a group called the Natural Solutions Foundation, which has a website, healthfreedomusa.org, that site's a good place for people to go if they want to get educated on this issue. And what she's done is she's tried to reach out to healthcare professionals in other countries, especially, to build a coalition to change this idea of toxic risk analysis, which may not be a very sexy issue, but actually it's a very important one, and get the international regulations so that they will recognize the value of nutrition for maintaining health. Now, curiously enough, the World Health Organization, and which is the parent organization of this international food code, has indicated that the people who run the food code have to change their attitude. Well, actually, the term was changed, was to review their terms of reference and begin to take account of the benefit of good nutrition for health, and not just assume that you need pharmaceuticals for health. I think there is a struggle on an international level right now between those who just see food as a sort of a supplement to pharmaceuticals and those who people see good nutrition as the foundation for good health.
Would you predict that nutrients and supplements are going to go up in price tremendously if this passes?
And there's no question about price. And not only just tremendously, but the biggest problem would be whether they'd be available or not, because let's assume that the worst nightmare of the system evolved, and it's like Germany is today, where you can't buy coenzyme Q10, where you can't buy more than a little 60 milligram tablets of vitamin C that you sort of chew and swallow, and you can't even get a doctor's prescription to buy a 1 gram vitamin C capsule, because physicians aren't allowed to prescribe vitamins to treat disease, because that's not standard medicine. No one's allowed to use vitamins to treat disease, apparently. And you're left with no alternatives. And that's the danger we face.
You've been working really hard.
But there is a coalition growing of third world countries especially who have traditional alternative approaches to illness. And some of those traditional approaches have been in use for thousands of years and been effective in their cultures. And they don't want to particularly give up effective local remedy systems for very expensive pharmaceutical systems that in the Western world leave hundreds of thousands of people a year dying of, as we said, doctor-induced and hospital-induced disease. So there is a growing awareness around the world that good health starts with good nutrition. And good health starts with people keeping control of their own health care alternatives.
You've been working very hard on this project and other projects. Is this group offering an alternative, or just want to turn this codex?
Actually, that's one of the things we did. I and another attorney who's active in the area, along with a physician and others, sat down and actually rewrote the what's called the Vitamin and Mineral Guideline, which is this part of the International Food Code, Codex Alimentarius, that would have restrictions. And we rewrote it to remove those restrictions and to promote good nutrition for health instead of restricted, and to recognize dietary supplements as foods that are not in need of being treated as toxins. So that's been a very, very positive development. We've helped, in addition to redrafting the international guidelines, we've drafted a model act for regulating dietary supplements in countries which don't have laws in that area yet, and there are many that don't. And that model act is based on the American law, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, which is the law that gave Americans the right to know truthful information about dietary supplements. And we took that and we used it as a model, and we also made sure that, Congress in its writing, sometimes a little confusing, and so the original law has some language in it that has allowed the bureaucrats far too many loopholes. And so we tried to close some of those up so that the supplement industry has the opportunity to continue the development of products that people want and that help people.
I think this could get out of hand that, okay, you can't buy vitamin D milk and you can't have extra vitamin C in your orange juice and you can't have niacin put in whole wheat bread.
Well, now that's very interesting. Now you've just shown that that there are large economic interests, such as bread manufacturers and others, who want to continue those practices. And so it isn't just the pharmaceutical world that wants to take over the vitamin world, but there are other food processors who understand the value of nutrient-added foods. And I think that they're certainly going to fight for their right to continue offering the products on the market that the market wants.
The last time I read statistics, there are 17 million people who take vitamins on a regular basis and about triple that who take them on off and on. That's a big pile of money that somebody wants to control.
That certainly is true.
And I
and we've seen that in the consolidation on the top of the vitamin industry, where many of the very largest vitamin companies have now been purchased by pharmaceutical companies.
I really resent the fact that I couldn't go to the store and get vitamin C if I had the sniffles. I got to go to the doctor and be dictated by the insurance company. I don't like that kind of control that people are trying to take over my life.
Yeah.
I think we all should be very concerned about this. Another thing I'm tremendously concerned about is these vaccinations and forced
vaccinations.
Absolutely.
Very concerned about that. Are you aware that the flu vaccine still has mercury in it. Although they've allegedly been taking the mercury out of the childhood vaccinations, apparently the flu vaccine, for various reasons, still has mercury in it. And it's interesting, flu season. We were told there wasn't enough vaccine to go around in this flu season. And interestingly enough, we've had a very mild flu season. I wonder if there's some connection between the vaccine and the flu. There are a number of people who argue just that connection, where they say that there's never enough coverage of the population to get what's called the herd effect, where you, you've vaccinated enough of the herd that the whole herd is protected. We never reach that level. in any of these vaccination programs.
In the study,
and so the herd effect is not helping us. And yet we experience the flu. It could very well be that the flu is being actually distributed by the vaccination system as opposed to being prevented. There simply haven't been enough real long-term studies to show the vaccination is safe or effective. It is essentially a myth that it is effective. And the proof of the pudding is, going back to your point about insurance companies, the private insurance companies would not insure vaccination in this country, just like they would not insure nuclear power. These were uninsurable risks. That's the proper term. And when an insurance company won't insure something, it should be a red flag. You know, we should realize that something is amiss. Well, instead of realizing something is amiss, in both the nuclear power example and in the vaccination example, the Congress of the United States passed laws basically abolishing liability. And in the case of vaccination, there's something called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that actually compensates people who are injured by vaccines to the tune of several hundred million dollars a year being spent compensating the families of children who die or who are otherwise injured. It's basically children in the case of vaccines who get injured. And that's very similar to what the nuclear industry has with its program, with its law that limits any claims to a special fund in the event of any accident. There's no insurance to cover either.
In a study,
and as I said, that ought to be a red flag.
With voice analysis, we can show that thimerosal renders inert the ability to use several forms of vitamin A. It affects hearing and actin, and we run people through this little pre-vac program. We can show those risk factors of what's going on. And one of the things that's very consistent is if your kids are forced to have vaccinations, get them by flavonoids so they can turn those vaccinations into something positive rather than just having them run around the system of the body causing problems. But they are forced vaccinations, and a lot of places they won't let you put your kids in school without vaccinations. Is that really a law? Because I've heard of a lot of parents.
Yes, there are many, almost, I'm sure every state has a statute that requires vaccination for entry into the school system and staying in the school system. But most of those laws have provisions for people who have religious objections to vaccination. And many people, because of the substances in the vaccination, because of the way the vaccinations are made using various types of fetal tissue and whatnot, object strongly to it on religious grounds. And to varying degrees of success. I mean, the authorities sometimes fight individuals and sometimes don't. When individual parents are willing to push enough, they do get their children removed from that system. And remember, the childhood vaccination system does not provide herd protection. It allegedly provides protection to some percentage of the children involved.
30 seconds.
At the cost of...
Yeah, 30 seconds.
Okay, Ralph, we're going to have to...
All right. Thank you, Sherry. Thank you ever so much.
This is absolutely wonderful information. We have a lot more to talk about. I want to leave you with a thought of how do you measure success? Money, power, satisfaction, making a difference, accomplishments, being honored, being loved by how your kids turned out, by how much more you have than your neighbor.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.